I met Elie, I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
And I guess I better get this right. Since she drove down here, I don't want to have to walk home. Well, y'all in a treat tonight. My wife here, Kay, and I met her right here at the Howell place, you know. I forget where she was sitting at the time, but I think it was back there. you know, I'm at home tonight. The Howell place is home for both of us. And, you know, any time we get to come down here is... it's a blessing, and I don't know, I don't want to take up too much time, and I had it all planned out what I was going to say before I got up here, but I think everybody here enjoy Kay tonight. Come on up, baby.
Yeah!
Oh, y'all keep clapping for Eddie Lee.
No!
I told him, I said, don't try to be funny. He said, I am funny. Oh, my goodness. It is home. My name is Kay. I'm an alcoholic.
Yay.
I am a grateful, recovered alcoholic. Recovered, not cured. Some of you have been told that this is going to be really funny tonight, haven't you? Somebody told you that, oh, she's real funny. Well, I ain't getting paid for this gig, so it may not be funny. But I will tell you... I will tell you about that story in a minute, but I'll tell you my two favorite AA jokes. Okay, the first one is a guy walks into a bar the day after the night before and walks up to the bartender and he said, man, he said, did you see me in here last night? And he said, yeah. He said, I cashed my whole paycheck and I had it in my pocket and I lost $800 in here last night. He goes, man, you didn't lose it. You bought everybody in here 3 rounds of drink. He said, thank God I thought I lost that money. And the other one is, because this has affected my life in different areas, is that the difference between an alcoholic, a drug addict, and an Al-Anon, untreated Al-Anon codependent, is an alcoholic will drive his car into a tree and get out and go, whew, I have got to quit driving. A drug addict will drive that same car into that same tree and get out and go, I don't care, it ain't my car. I stole it. But an untreated Al-Anon, a codependent, will get out there the next day and cut that tree down saying, you'll never cause this to happen again. So there, that y'all had a laugh. So that's my favorite joke, jokes or whatever. So I'm supposed to tell you a little bit about what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. Before I get into that, I want to tell you how I found my alcoholism. I came into this program, but Logan had to mention it a while ago and asked me if I still had my stalker. I came into this program September 10th, 1995. I'm one of those one-chip wonders that you hear about. Mike Cook used to say, I don't believe anybody's got one white chip. but I do, and I always said to him, you know, it's a wonder I live to get that one. But it took me a while, even in these rooms, to find my alcoholism, and reading the promises like this is how I found my alcoholism, because I didn't live under a bridge, I didn't drink every day like my daddy had. I thought that, you know, all of that's what looked like an alcoholic. It's when I heard the promises read like this. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I would be amazed before I was halfway through. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I would know a new freedom and a new happiness. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I would not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I could comprehend the word serenity and I would know peace. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, no matter how far down the scale I was going, I could see how my experience could benefit others. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, that feeling of uselessness and self-pity would disappear and reappear and disappear. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I would lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in my fellows. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, self-seeking would slip away. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, my whole attitude and outlook upon life would change. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, fear of people and of economic insecurity would leave me. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I would intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle me. And whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I would suddenly realize that alcohol was doing for me what I could not do for myself. So that's how I found my alcoholism. I was born into an alcoholic home in a little town. You may have heard of it. Little town with nothing there called Alpharetta, Georgia. Oh, it's a big hoity-toity place now, but we had dirt and two traffic lights when I grew up there, and one town drunk who I called Daddy. And it was like the Mayberry of Georgia, Alpharetta was back then. And so I was born into an alcoholic home. I had an alcoholic father, admitted alcoholic father, and an unadmitted mother. My mom had a black belt in Southern Baptist religion. I grew up knowing everything that was going to send me to hell. I didn't know anything that was going to keep me out of it. And I did not grow up in church. We looked at that as a place where people go when their lives are perfect, and our lives aren't perfect. And I remember spending a lot of my childhood as a good little Al-Anon, you know, didn't know that's what it was called, but trying to fix Daddy and trying to save Daddy. I remember even at like 8, 9 years old, my mom said to us, because Daddy always just drank beer. And, I'll get that. That's for me. I'm busy. Hey, don't feel bad. I was up here telling my story one night and a phone kept going off. And I looked over and I was like, well, somebody turn that off. And Eddie goes, baby, it's yours. So don't feel bad at all. So about 8 or 9 years old, I remember a scenario where my mom, we had a little pint of whiskey in the house, because that was for me, because I would get bronchitis a lot when I was a kid, and Mama would give me whiskey and sugar as cough syrup, and I was so grateful for that. I figured out later, I would fake coughing to get her to give me more. So I understood that after I got sober was the phenomenon of craving that we talk about in here. But I remember we had that little bottle of whiskey in the cabinet, and Mama said she was going to get all of us a sip of it, and we would gargle in it, and we'd smell like alcohol when Daddy got home from work, and we'd stagger around and act like we were drunk, and he would now know what it would be like to live with an alcoholic. Well, of course, if any of you in here are alcoholics, you know that the only thing that did to Daddy was like, as long as you don't touch my beer, I'm fine. And, but I remember all of the insanity that went along with that, trying to save Daddy. My mom divorced my dad when I was 13 years old, and we owned two houses that were side by side. Well, he moved into his parents' old house, and we kept our house. And he was still coming over every night after he would get off work and still drinking and still passing out at the kitchen table. So now, instead of walking him down the hall to the bedroom, now we got to walk him up the hill and next door to his bedroom in the other house. So my mom and I have a brother, an older brother, and but my mom and I moved into an apartment about 6 miles away in the city limits of Alpharetta. And we'd only been there 2 months. When we got the dreaded phone call one night that we had always feared, because Daddy would fall asleep or pass out rather with a cigarette in his hand, and he caught his bed on fire a couple of times, and one night our house was built really tight. My granddaddy had built it, and so my mom had come in late, and Daddy had set the cotton mattress on fire, and it was just a miracle that we didn't all die of smoke inhalation. But February 2nd, 1976, we got the phone call that said, a house is on fire on Francis Road. It's the home of a J.D. Dodd, and my daddy's name was J.T., and they found a body. And I went up there with my mom and her friends. They took us up there, and my brother was living with my dad at the time, and so that was the longest drive I've ever had in my life, laying in the back seat of that car, not knowing what to hope for, not knowing what to pray for and not knowing what we were going to find when we got there, because it was either my brother or my daddy. And I remember I just laid in the back seat crying and praying that whoever it was didn't suffer, that they didn't suffer. And so when we got there and I found out that it was my dad, you know, I went back to high school the next week. There was a lot of sympathy that went with he died in a fire. And see, back then, autopsies and death reports and all that kind of death certificates took a long time to get it back. And so that's the story that we all went with. He died in a fire. And there was a lot of sympathy that went with that. So 30 days later, when we got the death certificate that said alcohol poisoning, unintentional overdose of alcohol, I didn't go back and tell anybody that. In fact, I had said for so many years that my dad died in a fire, I had begun to believe it myself. And just being the good little alcoholic that I was, the very substance that in writing showed me that took my dad's life, he died February 2nd, 1976. Sometime between there and July of 76 is when I started drinking. And I'm pretty sure it was in the spring of that year. I started with vodka. I had screwdriver, you know, drinking vodka, whatever, orange juice. I go in Waffle House now and order a virgin screwdriver. But I just like to mess with them. But so that was the night of my first drink, and I drank myself into a blackout that night. And you'd think that that would be a wake-up call. But all I looked at is I had to find a way to make it last long, you know, like to spread it out over more hours. I figured out I drank too much too fast. That was the problem. And so the next weekend, and then I added other things to the mix, which I won't talk about that tonight, but alcohol's not the only thing that's a part of my story, but it's part that we're going to talk about tonight. And so that was the night of my first official drink. Like I said, I believe I brought an alcoholic to my first drink at 8 years old when my mother stuck that tablespoon of whiskey as cough syrup in my mouth. And so now here I'm 14 years old, I'm drinking and just trying to forget. I had a pretty rough childhood even before all this with dad, you know, my dad. I had been abused as a child outside the home, and so I justified every drink I had. If this had happened to you, you'd drink too, and yada, 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 all the stuff that we do. And I drank like that, or did other things, from 14 to 34. I walked through the doors, or rather, I crawled through the doors of this building September 10th, 1995. And honestly, I didn't come here to get sober. I really did. I told my mama I was coming up here because it was a prayer meeting. And that was something she understood. So I was like, well, they pray a lot. They hold hands and say the Lord's Prayer. So I was coming up here because my best friend had gotten sober, and she invited me. She invited me to my first meetings when I met Heather. My friend was 30 days sober, and she kept saying, well, you need to come here, Jimmy. You need to come here, Jimmy. And this woman who had been like a god to me, who helped me solve all of my problems, was now all of a sudden going, well, you just need to pray about it. Why don't you pray about it? Why don't you just pray about it? And I was like, why don't you pray about it? And I was like, I'm going to go buy me a parrot at a pet store and teach it to go, pray about it, pray about it, because that's all you're doing, and I can just have that and not have to deal with you. And so so she invited me to come hear Jimmy talk. Now, those of you that know Jimmy Egan, you sit right here in this chair, Sunday morning Sunday school skippers group at 11 o'clock. That's what we called it back then, the Sunday Serenity and Spirituality hoity-toity group. No, I'm just kidding. I love that group. But I came in here and sat right there where we're sitting tonight, and Jimmy didn't say a word through the whole meeting. Well, that made me mad, and because it cut into some of my getting high time. It's like, well, now I've done wasted an hour on Sunday morning. And I remember Heather and Carmen came running over because they thought, oh, new blood, you know. And they're giving me their phone numbers. And I'm like, I don't want your phone numbers. I didn't know why they were giving me their phone numbers. And I didn't realize they thought that I wanted to be here. And and God forbid that I needed to be here. And so I had to go back out and continue that journey. But I think that there was probably some things that I heard that day. It all kind of came out like Charlie Brown's teacher, like wah, 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 wah. I really felt like when I walked out of here, I couldn't relate to anything. Well, another 60 days went by, and I continued to do my thing and continued to be around the kind of people that I was, you know, that we're around when we're doing our thing. And to back up a little bit, in July 1991, 4 years before I got sober, I don't even know how to say this, I became a comedian. I mean, I quit my day job, and I took this class from a guy in Atlanta. And everybody always asked me, what made you decide to become a comedian? I was like, well, I couldn't hold a day job. So I kept getting fired from my mouth. But but I did. I started in stand-up comedy July 1st of 1991. And by August of 92, I was full-time road comic. And that suited my lifestyle real well. Because now I'm gone all the time. Nobody's really seeing how much I'm drinking, what I'm doing. And so I had been traveling full-time as a road comic for 3 years when I got sober. So I was actually, the weekend that I got sober, I was in, where I hit my bottom was on the floor of the Radisson Suites Hotel in Augusta, Georgia. I had been dating a guy that worked at the comedy club. And, you know, I mean, there's nothing wrong with the kind of job that he had. It's just that... he didn't have a whole lot of aspirations in life, and that suited me fine because I just wanted to be high all the time. And but then I'd taken a turn, you know, and decided I wanted to straighten my life out again, and so I had broken up with him. Well, that didn't set real well with him, and you know, when we're crazy, we don't exactly attract the smartest people on the planet. And and so he started threatening me, started calling me at the hotel, you know, all this kind of crazy stuff. And so when I came home, I actually left that gig, which is something I never did before and have never done since. But I ended up leaving Augusta that Friday, and my best friend Kathy, some of y'all know her, Happy Kathy, bless her, she lives in Savannah, Georgia now. But I went to her house when I got home that night, and I said, well, at least I've hit rock bottom. I can't go anywhere from here but up. And she got right in my face, and she said, oh, no, you ain't hit rock bottom yet because you're not 6 feet under. And she said, but you keep doing what you're doing with the people that you're doing it with, and if they don't kill you, you're going to end up killing yourself. And I was like, ooh. That didn't sit real well with me. So I immediately started plotting her death. And and I'm going to have to go now. And so I left and continued doing my thing the next 24 to 48 hours. And she told me that night, she said, Sunday morning I'm getting my 90-day chip at the Howe place if you want to come. And so she invited me to come again. And through the course of events over that weekend, I went back to my my counselor, finally admitted to her that I had barely drawn a sober breath from 14 to here I was at 34. And she was like, Kay, you got a problem I can't help you with. And so I thought, well, I can manage this myself. Besides, you know, I'm not one of them. I'm not like a real alcoholic or anything. And so I thought I was, you know, just going to handle it myself. Well, before the afternoon was over, I was already high again. And so that night, my cousin had come down from South Carolina, and she was kind of helping me navigate through. This guy was calling me now. He's going to come to my house, and, you know, he's going to come get me, and all, you're going to take me back, and all this, you know, all the stuff that shows you how much they love you. And I always say, I never met an alcoholic that didn't stalk me until Eddie. But I set my alarm. I found a moment of insanity that night, I found a moment of clarity. I'm sorry, I had a bunch of moments of insanity. I found a moment of clarity that night, and I set my alarm to go hear her, to go come here to see her get her 90-day chip. And again, I was sitting right there. And the first time I came, nothing made sense. But that time, I couldn't wait until they stopped talking and gave out the chips, because I knew it's where I needed. This is where I needed to be. Still didn't know quite why. I still could not bring myself to say I'm an alcoholic. I would just kind of blah, blah, blah. But I just about turned that table over, going to get a white chip that morning. And if some of you know this story, there's a few of you here that were probably here that day. So that was Sunday morning, September 10th. I had to leave Tuesday morning to drive to Memphis. I was showcasing for Carnival Cruise Lines in Memphis. And so I wanted to cram in as many meetings as I could, because I had to drive to Memphis Tuesday, do a show Tuesday night, drive to Greenville, South Carolina Wednesday, do a show Wednesday night. So it was probably going to be Thursday before I was in a place. Oh, this is moving. I felt the earth move. Okay. So I wanted to cram in as meetings as I could. So I come here 11 o'clock Sunday morning. I come back 7 o'clock Sunday night. I come to the 10:30 meeting. I go to lunch. I come back to the 1 o'clock meeting here. And during the meeting, this used to be, I used to say it was a non-smoking table, but it really should have been called like a non-smoking chair, because there was nobody there. Hardly ever sat here. Everybody was over here smoking, including me. But there were two guys sitting at this table. And I don't even know what happened, but one said something during the meeting and, you know, the other didn't like it. And so then the next person's sharing. The next thing we know is they're in a fight rolling around on the floor. And if you're new, that has never happened before and has never happened since. But it just so happened it happened that day. And so, you know, just being the way that we are here in the program, you know, they pull them apart, get them set down, settle down, you know, get over it, whatever, and sit back down. The chairperson goes, "Well, who'd like to share now?" You know? And of course, I'm saying, "Well, not me, you know. I don't want to get pummeled." And and some of you know who Indian Charlie is. He was here that Sunday morning, so I recognized him. And so I go up to him, and I was like, "Charlie, what was that? Why did that happen?" He goes, "Well, for some reason, your higher power wanted you to see it, so just keep coming back to me." And I was like, okay. So that was my 2 days of sobriety right there. So I get to South Carolina, I drove to Memphis, literally got there just in time to do the show, got up the next morning. I don't know if y'all have ever driven across the state of Tennessee, but it's a long state. And so I had to drive from Memphis to Greenville, South Carolina to do a show Wednesday night. And so now by Thursday, I am beat. I'm laying in the bed. I don't want to go anywhere. I looked up the meetings. There was one about 15 minutes away at 5 o'clock. I had a show at 8:30. So she later became my sponsor. So Kathy, happy Kathy, called to see how I was doing. And when I told her, I was like, "Well, but you know, it's like 15 minutes away and it's in a church basement and it's non-smoking. I just don't think I can go. I'm so tired." And she goes, "How long you been sober?" And I was like, 4 days. She's like, 5 days ago, would you have driven 15 minutes to get a bottle of vodka, even if you couldn't smoke?" I was like, "Yeah." She said, "Get your butt out of that bed and go to that meeting." And I did. And that's the kind of sponsorship that I had, y'all, was that kind. It's not exactly that way now. I think for some people it is, but that's the kind of hard knocks that I needed. And I went straight from Greenville to Columbia, South Carolina the next week, and got there and got to the hotel just in time to make it. I called the intergroup office. They said, "Oh, there's a meeting at 5:30. Got just enough time to get over there. Well, they couldn't tell me that when I got to Broad River Road, whether I should turn right or left. They weren't sure. And so that made me mad. So I had lived in Columbia for 5 months before I hit my bottom. And so I drive over there, and I get to that traffic light, and I was just so stressed, and I didn't know, turn right, turn left. You know, I'm all of 1 week sober now, y'all, if you can even call that sober. And but I turned left instead of right. If I'd have just slowed down enough and looked, I would have seen a billow of smoke coming out of the side of this church, because the smokers met outside. And so I was late getting there, and after the meeting was over, and then they did this thing, I don't know if y'all have ever been in a meeting where they just toss it to the next person. So you share and you want to hear somebody else share. You call on them yourself. Well, nobody knew me. Nobody knew how much wisdom I had. So nobody called on me. So when the meeting was over, I needed them to know why I was 15 minutes late. It was intergroup's fault. And the woman, I was like, who's in charge? Are you in charge? You led the meeting. Are you in charge? And she was like, nobody's in charge. And, so I told her my issue. I was like, well, you need to tell the people at intergroup. They need to know how to get to these meetings. Because if I had to turn right instead of left, I'd been here on time, you know, and like my head spinning around, green pea soup coming out. And I'm crazy. And she looked at me and she goes, you haven't been sober very long, have you? I was like, 8 days, why do you ask? She said, well, first of all, do you know who runs our intergroup office? I was like, no, I'm not from here. I don't know who runs it. She said, a bunch of drunks like us. And that was pretty humbling little experience there. And so I just remember that was a good little lesson for me. I wish I hadn't shared like my first 5 years, y'all. People would tell me after a meeting, they'd be like, oh, I love to hear you share. I'd be like, I know, me too. I really wish I had waited about 5 years before I shared, because what I kept sharing, what Logan was referring to a while ago, is, and my sponsor, my second sponsor, because Kathy and I fired each other so we didn't kill each other, so I had to get another sponsor. But what I discovered in that is, because I kept saying in meetings, and anybody that was ever in a meeting with me back then, you heard me say, well, I was stalked into AA. I had a stalker. I was stalked into these rooms. So my new sponsor at 4 years sober had me do a 10th step. She wanted me to do a 4th step, but I told her I'd already done that. She said, all right, well, by cracky, I want you to do a 10th step. And so I did, and I got over to her house that day to talk about it, and she pretty much locked every door in the house. She said, you're not leaving until we get through some things. She said, number one, I want to know, why do you qualify for Alcoholics Anonymous? Because we're not Stalkers Anonymous. And all I've ever heard you say is you were stalked into these rooms. And so I started telling her my story of how I, you know, drank and didn't mean to drink. I swore that I wasn't going to drink, but then I would end up drunk. Or I would swear that I was only going to have one or two, and then I would end up drunk. So she had me go through a list of those. She said, okay, well, you qualify. And so she walked me through that process, and she revealed to me during that process, she said, every time I've heard you say you got here because you were stalked, she said, I would cringe. Because what I heard you saying is, I'm better than the rest of you because I didn't get here because of alcohol. I got here because I had a stalker. And I mean, you talk about busting somebody's ego down to the floor. She busted my ego down to the floor. And then suggested that I come back here and start revealing the rest of the story of the stalker. And I remember the first night, I'm going to pick on Heather again. I'm pretty sure I remember it being Heather, whether it's a correct memory or not. But I think it was Heather. The first time that I sat here in this meeting at Sober at Six and I shared that number one, he lived in Edgefield, South Carolina. I lived in Marietta, Georgia. This was in the early 90s, so we didn't have GPS and map systems and all the stuff that we have now. So he lived in Edgefield, South Carolina. He was a bar back at a comedy club. He was hoping the French fry guy would die so he'd get that job. He made 180, and there's nothing wrong with that job. It's just, like I said, he had no aspiration. He made $180 a week, so he wasn't going to jet set in here and fly in here. Let's see what else. He didn't have a car. He didn't have a driver's license. But the thing that really was the kicker is he didn't know where I lived. And so I share all that at this meeting this night, and I'm pretty sure it was Heather. Somebody, the chairperson says, anybody got a burning desire? And that hand went up. She said, I would just like to express my extreme disappointment with Kay Stalker. She said, because for all these years, I have envisioned this huge guy outside her house with a knife, and now he didn't even know where she lived. Anyway, I don't know if that was you or not, but I attribute that to that memory to you. So I had to get real over and over and over again, y'all. And one of the reasons my sponsor made me do that step work again is she's like, you're never finished working the steps, Kay. You're never finished. I mean, maybe you work them a few times until you learn to live them. But this is a design for living, that you have said that you will live this life that demands rigorous honesty, that you will, you know, walk this path and yada, yada, yada. And, you know, and all this time, I'm still working comedy clubs at that time. And so from the day I got sober, from the day I picked up that white chip, the fight broke out the next day. And then the next night, I'm in a bar because I work in bars. And I lived in a house where there was alcohol. And so I am not, I mean, I don't recommend that, but I also subscribe to the belief that you're either done or you're not. And for me, I just really felt like I was done, even though at that time I didn't even really know, like I said, I didn't really subscribe to the belief that I was a true alcoholic. I was probably about 6 months sober, and where's Mary? And it was Sherry Arledge. She has a cup in that cabinet right there. Sherry is one of my dearest friends in sobriety. I was her sponsor. she died in my presence in February of 2005, right before we both would have turned 10 years sober that year. That's why Alabama has on that shirt tonight called Class of 95, because we all got sober together in 95, and in Sherry's memory, we did those shirts. But Sherry stood up here that night, and she talked about being given cough syrup, being given whiskey as cough syrup. So I was about 6 months sober when I found my alcoholism in that story, how I would fake coughing to get my mother to give me that whiskey again. Even though I said I hated it, I'd hack and gag and spit and beg and tell her not to do it again, and then I'd fake coughing so she'd give it to me again. And so, and I've heard it said, you know, one of these days, if you sit here long enough, somebody in one of these chairs or standing at one of these podiums will tell your story. And she did. She told my story that night. And y'all, it has been such an amazing journey. You know, Eddie and I met. He always says that he asked me out on a date. His 13th step in me was what it was. And I was still new. He asked me to go to, what is it, Kicks and Dunn, Dunn and Kicks, whatever. Brooks and Dunn. Kicks Brooks, that's it. He kind of looks like him. But he did. He asked me out and to go to that concert. And I said, oh, I was going to go see my mom was going to do a gospel singing that night. I was going to go to that. And then we ended up, after the 1 o'clock meeting, we all cleaned up and then went to Waffle House and came back for the 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock, whatever it was, that Saturday. And then I ended up staying for the 8 o'clock meeting. Well, he didn't go. He walks in the door and he said, I thought you had to wash your hair. but we didn't have our first date until right before I turned 1 year sober. And I'm so grateful for that, y'all, because Eddie and I were truly friends before we were ever anything else. And, you know, we got a baby girl that just turned 20 years old. I don't even know how that happened, but 20 years went by. But what a ride sobriety is. And you know, I quit comedy in 2001. Kaylee was, we moved out to the boondocks in 2000. We bought this house, farmhouse out in the country. And, you know, Eddie was like, oh, it's a handyman's dream. And I went and looked at it, and I was like, oh, it looks like my nightmare, because it had been burned. And, of course, he saw the vision, because he's a carpenter and a visionary and an artist when it comes to wood. And all I saw was dirt and smoke and bleh. And, but we were fixing up that house. And about 5 years, 6 years into that journey, you know, I was still driving down here at the time, still driving down here to go to meetings. And it's like 60, 70 miles round trip to come to a meeting down here. And anyway, I was working for this lady in Cartersville, and I was on my way home from work with Kaylee in the car, and I got this phone call. It was November 15th, 2006. I call it the day the earth stood still for the Stokes family. And it was Eddie, and he was in the back of an ambulance headed to Kennestone Hospital. He had stepped off a ladder too soon and broke his diabetic foot in three places. And he managed to get his boot off before the swelling started. And but he was in this basement. It was pouring down rain. They had to get the gurney in. They were slipping and sliding, getting him out of there and all this stuff. And what was supposed to be a really simple broken foot, with him going back to work in 6 weeks, because I worked part-time, but he was our primary source of income at the time. I had quit comedy. I quit comedy in 2001. It was too far to drive, and, you know, just, I'd quit the road before Kaylee was born, and I just could not imagine going off and leaving her. But I was working little office jobs, little part-time stuff, but he was our primary source of income. What was supposed to be 6 weeks out of work turned into seven surgeries in 11 months time. But, you know, breaking his foot actually saved his life, because he was a ticking time bomb when it came to his vascular system. And so it was through all that, doing tests, and you know, it was just one thing after another. The bone healed, but the wound came open, and now they find the vascular problems in his leg, and they start doing stents, and then that didn't work, and now they say they got to do an aortic bifemoral bypass, but he's got to pass a stress test, which he failed. Now they send him to the cath lab, and they come out with this glum look on their face and said, your husband has had two heart attacks, and he needs a quadruple bypass today. And but I tell you, I tell that story to tell you how the family of Alcoholics Anonymous rallied around us during that time. I mean, I stood over my husband in the ICU at Kennestone Hospital with seven new orifices cut into his body and tubes coming out of every one of them. And I told God then, you take the house, you take the cars, you take the dogs, you can take the grass out of the yard. Just don't take him. Just keep us together. And it was quite a battle. I mean, there was touch and go, and they kept talking amputation of his foot. But Eddie had faith that he was, and he was just determined he was not going to lose that foot, and he didn't. And you know, we had a wound care nurse that he called his wound care angel, that she was just as determined as he was. And and so during all that time, you know, we would get to come back here, because we go to Kennestone and come through here and visit. And y'all, I just can't even tell you the miracles of support that came from that time. I mean, I'm so sure some of you have heard Eddie share that from time to time. But that is one of the things that I have found in life and in sobriety, just that complete and total surrender. You know, the first three steps, I heard it said early on that steps 1, 2, and 3, we give up. Steps 4, 5, and 6, we own up. Steps 7, 8, and 9, we make up. And 10, 11, and 12, we grow up. And but we have to live in the give up, own up, make up, and grow up. We have to live in that. And every time I have gotten to another place of thinking I know something, I would say that I suffer from terminal knowledge, but actually it's the people around me that suffer from it. I remember there was a movie years ago called Broadcast News, and little Holly Hunter and William Hurt were in it, and there was a scene in there where she was just like this little rat dog, you know, like she was just constantly telling her boss what to do. And he looked at her and he said, you know, it must be nice for you to be in this room full of this high a caliber of people and to know that you know perhaps more than any one of them or perhaps all of them put together, that you know more than that. And she welled up with tears. She said, no, it's not. It's awful. And yeah, let me tell you something. Knowledge is a dangerous thing for an alcoholic. But when I live in that give up, in that surrender, and realize that I ain't got it figured out, even at 20, almost 23, if I don't get stupid between now and September 10th, I'll have 23 years sobriety. But you know, I don't take that for granted, y'all. I mean, they say, you know, the further away you get from your last drink, the closer you are to your next drink and all that stuff. I don't know about all that. All I know is it still is a day at a time program for me. But just, you know, three years ago, I had it in my mind what I was supposed to be doing was I was running this little theater that our daughter was in, and, you know, I pretty much had all that figured out, and that's what I was supposed to be doing. And I started back doing comedy for them. I was opening the shows for them. And I just knew that that was what I was supposed to be doing, you know. And yet all this time, just all this turmoil was happening and all these things that were so obvious that I didn't need to be doing that. One of the things that was so obvious is my husband kept trying to tell me it's too much. I was a volunteer there. I was working 40 hours a week or more as a volunteer. And he kept telling me, baby, it's too much. It's too much. Well, Kaylee gets free tuition and driving from Cucamonga, where we live, all the way to Marietta over here at Shalford Road, every day for 2 weeks at a time, four times a year to do a show. And but I finally listened and surrendered. And y'all, I told you, I got out of stand-up comedy, you know, got out of the bars. I really felt like that was just the thing that I could not, I just did not, not that I was being tempted by the alcohol, it got to a point in my sobriety where I could just no longer support that environment. You know, because part of the thing of being on stage as a comedian is, oh, drink up, you know, party and all that. And I just couldn't do that. I just could not subscribe to that. And so I had gotten out of that. Well, I knew that at some point I was going to do comedy again, but I wanted it to be to where I could tell my story. And here I am helping run this theater. I couldn't really go out in front of them and go, hey, my name's Kay, I'm an alcoholic, you know. And they're like dropping their babies off with the ex-drunk. And I couldn't really go out there and tell my story. And so in 2015, God opened a door, and it took a little swift kick in the tail to get me to walk through it. But I want to tell you something. I started back doing comedy full time. Now, I do it in theaters and churches and family arenas. I don't know what y'all heard about me. Some of you may have been told that I'm religious. I'm really not. I've driven by some religious people, but I'm not. I talk privately about who my God is. I will tell you, he ain't conference approved, but his daddy is. And thank you for getting that. So I primarily do, you know, that arena. I'm not a preacher. I mean, last time I preached, four people got lost, so they don't let me preach. But I knew that was what I was supposed to be doing, so that I could tell my story. And I tell my recovery story in churches and theaters and all this. So prior to 2015, my point with all that is, prior to that, I was in front of 1,000 people a year at that theater, about 100, 120 per show for a year, 1,000, maybe 1,200 for a year. When I let go and let God, when I surrendered, when I gave up and just said, God, I mean, it took a lot of pain to get me to give up, y'all. He was going to pry that out of my hand, my cold, dead hands. But when I gave up, May 18th, 2015, is when I walked out that door. And it looked stupid. It looked crazy. I'm going to go pursue stand-up comedy full-time. Oh, you got a lot of stuff booked? I got one. I have one date on the books, and it was coming up in about 3 weeks. In 3 years, y'all, what God has done from 12 shows a year in front of 1,000 people, in 3 years, there's been 80 shows in 57 cities, in 14 states, in front of over 30,000 people.
Wow.
That's what giving up can do. So I just encourage you. I know this wasn't as funny as some of you thought it would be. But I just encourage you to get in the book. You know, there's a lot of things. One of the things I do want to say is that when I hear somebody say in AA, this is a selfish program, I literally cringe. Because our book, there is absolutely nothing about sobriety that is selfish. It is selfless. And our book says that we are to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and His children, to God and His people. And so just get to know the AA Big Book. I don't care what your addiction is. I don't care what it is. There is a design for living in that book that works. And it works for all of us. And, you know, I was going to, I didn't really talk about, because at about 5 years sober, I hit a bottom with the other side of the disease with Al-Anon, because Eddie's brother was living up here. He was living right next door in this, what used to be a trailer park, and he was dying. I mean, he was literally dying from this disease. And being the good little, you know, untreated Al-Anon that I was, trying to save Daddy, you know, so I go over there one night trying to save him. He called and was crying, and, you know, and Eddie just looked at it. He's like, he's drunk. He'll be all right. You know, I'll go see him tomorrow. And I'm like, no, I got to go back. I got to go get my cape out of the cleaners. Here she comes to save the day. So I go driving over there to try to save him. And before I left there, I was ready to kill him. Because let me tell you something. Untreated alcoholics think about suicide. Untreated Al-Anons, we think about homicide. And so I had started going to our sister program. And my favorite Al-Anon joke, I'll tell you this, is to get into AA, all you got to have is a desire to stop drinking. But to get into Al-Anon, you got to know somebody. I know a lot of somebodies. So I just want to encourage you, get in the book, know what it says, and live life. I mean, I talked about Jimmy a little bit while ago. I call him my Jimmy. I've even thought about writing a little memoir about my time with Jimmy, because Jimmy was kind of a spiritual sponsor to me. He was about 40 years my senior, so when I was in my 30s, Jimmy was already in his 70s. Not sure what year Jimmy died. I know Kaylee was about 3 or 4 years old, so probably around 2003. And Jimmy, you know, he was a spiritual giant in my life, but not because Jimmy thought that he was a giant. He was a very humble man. And I remember he took me and this other lady over to his house one Sunday, because she and I were both crying in the meeting that day. And he's like, come on, kid, we're going to go to my house. You're going to talk to Jimmy about all these tears and stuff. And Jimmy had served time in Attica. And so he said, I'm going to make you girls pepper and eggs sandwiches for breakfast. And so we did that. And I hope I never forget that time with Jimmy, because during that time, he dropped a spoonful of eggs on the floor. And he bent down and scooped it up with a spoon and stuck it in his mouth. And he stood there and looked at me, and he said, you know why I do that, kid? He said, because I don't want to ever forget that my floor. He said, well, number one, I had rheumatoid arthritis so bad that I couldn't bend over, but God healed me of that. But I also don't ever want to forget that my floor is cleaner than the plates I had to eat off of in Attica. And I was in Attica because of alcohol. And so it was that kind of stuff that, you know, hearing early on that And I always say, Jimmy, you know, he was the reason I came to a meeting. I was invited. Of course, I was about a year sober when I realized she didn't invite nobody else to come. She invited the other alcoholic she knew in her life. And but I'm going to close with this because this was one of my favorite things that Jimmy used to say, is that I know that I am not the woman. I will mess it up. I can. Don't mess me up, Dean. Yes, I may not be the woman I want to be, but I thank God, you people in this program, I am not the woman that I used to be. Thank y'all so much. God bless you.